The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order today. It's Thursday, March the 12th. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum. And we are ready to start with Senate File 638, Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, thank you. And current law, draw your attention, obviously, to it's just a single-page bill. And you can see that current law says that the requirement for prompt payment to subcontractors, this has to do with building and construction contractors and subcontractors. Current law says that it does not apply to the construction of residential real estate or to construction or of improvements to attach single-family dwellings if they're used for residential purposes and have fewer than 13 units per structure. So the issue is, or what the bill wants to do is say, no, the prompt payment law, which is up above, which reads up above you in current law, that when there is undisputed work, or it's actually the language of services provided by the party requesting payment, that they will shall be paid within 10 days. And that would apply now to subcontractors who work on residential property. And I think it's a fair this bill came out of the business industry and jobs. I was looking at Senator Olson, and I thought, well, you know, Mary, you should, excuse me, Senator Olson, this should be familiar to you because I'm sure we had it in Commerce. But no, we didn't. We had it in business industry and jobs, so you wouldn't have heard of it before.
Sure.
So anyway.
Senator Scheid, do you have anybody, any witnesses to testify on the bill?
I think Mr. Straczynski wants to do that.
Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I represent the Minnesota Electrical Association and the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Roofing Contractors Association. Just a quick bit of history, and I'll be brief. I know you have a very busy agenda today. I was involved in this legislation in 1997 when it first went into law, and there was lots of pieces to this legislation at the time, dealing with the prompt pay and subcontractors, Bill of Rights, we called it at the time. 90% of it was agreed to, and this one provision was left out because there was still disagreement, continuing disputes with the home builders at that time. And we did limit it to 13 or smaller, fewer units. There's been issues in recent years dealing with subcontractors or contractors, home builders. You get paid not paying a subcontractor within 10 days. And this bill, strictly on its surface, deals with if you've been paid for undisputed claims by the bank or the owner or whatever, based on the work that the subcontractor did, you got to pay me within 10 days as well, or these sanctions, legal fees, and whatever apply. To tell you, there's some disagreement on this legislation. I've met with the Home Builders Association and other groups of subcontractors yesterday. I thought we had an issue worked out and making a little bit easier understanding the nuances, the state of the terms of the art, like draws and things that the home builders are concerned about. It kind of unraveled, Madam Chair, just a little while ago. But I'm here to tell you we're going to continue to work on that. I talked to Pam Perry Weaver and others, and Remy Stone and others involved in this issue. We'll continue to improve it as we go along for the home builders and address some of their concerns. I'm pretty comfortable we can put a final package together at some time, but Madam Chair, it needs to keep moving. It still has got a clear full committee in the House of Representatives, and I told Senator Scheid we're happy to continue to work on this stuff, and I'll be involved, and hopefully we can come to some resolution. But on its surface, it's not a bad bill, but we'll make it better for the home builders.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and I was I have a bill that the builders had asked me to carry that includes this very provision. It has, however, some other provisions in it. This came from a group of newly organized subcontractors, and obviously it doesn't take a whole lot of thinking to figure out that these are tough times and people are hurting. And subcontractors need to be paid just as contractors need. And so I just think it's a fairness issue. I think all by itself, just with what it's doing, because all it's doing is striking this exception to the prompt payment requirement, that I think it would be fine if this became law as it is. And if there's something else that's needed, comfort language or whatever it might be, that would be fine with me.
But you're satisfied with the language.
But I don't have anything here.
As before us. So Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Schein, and again, unless I guess we're going to hear from another witness, so maybe that person will raise something I haven't thought of, but it just seems to me that in addition to being an issue of fairness between subcontractors and contractors, that the other party to be considered is the homeowner. And if a person's lien, if subcontractors haven't been paid, then a person is, you know, the homeowner can be exposed to the possibility of a lien waiver foreclosure and perhaps that could lead to a foreclosure on the house, which is something we're trying to avoid in these times. So it's also, from my standpoint or how I'm viewing this, is sort of a homeowner protection bill as well.
Senator Scheid, is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill?
I'm sure.
I'd like to simply say, response to Senator Olson as well. You're exactly correct. And you should also know that subcontractors, like electrical contractors, they've got suppliers that need to be paid too. So this bill also requires, subcontractors need to pay their subcontractors as well in order to prevent liens being filed on this. And the sanctions are pretty severe if you don't pay your subs. Thank you.
Good. Senator Lemire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Scheid, I just came into the room and I'm catching up to your bill. When a real estate closing takes place, that's when lien waivers are sought by the closer in order to effectively close the sale. To the best of their knowledge, they want everyone to be paid off. This is basically on new construction. I haven't heard that discussion on the requirement for lien waivers to be satisfied at the time of a real estate closing in your presentation. How would that affect a real estate closing? They're supposed to do it anyway at the point of sale, and I don't necessarily see that here. Is this trying to satisfy the liens before a real estate closing? Because usually builders aren't, for the most part, they're under a building contract with the potential homeowner, and everyone gets paid at the time of closing. In your case, is the lien waiver sought before the closing table?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, actually, this may or may not involve a real estate closing. Probably does, but I think the situation could arise even when there's not a closing to be had, when there's been work done by a contractor, perhaps building an addition on a home. You wouldn't go through the closing and the title and all of that at that point. But this is about just payment as you go, as you're performing the work.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, why don't you take some action if you're talking about going on a periodic basis? I mean,
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, there is that progress payment piece in statute as well. This bill is only about the prompt payment. We didn't go into the other progress payment. This has to do when the work's been performed. When the subcontractor has performed the work and it's undisputed, they've done it, there are no questions about the work, it's been done to the degree, you know, to the quality that it was supposed to be, then the contractor would have 10 days to pay the subcontractor. But they already do that,
Madam
for
Chair.
All other kinds of...
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, my experience was that you take and make an agreement that in various stages of the contract would be fulfilled, that you would get a payment after 10 days or whatever it was, and then 20. And is that not adequate in dealing with this particular harm you're talking about?
I think, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, Mr. Straczynski can probably help me with
Straczynski.
That.
Madam
Chair, I think you have to take a look at it in the simplest terms. The trigger mechanism is when the contractor has been paid by the homeowner or by the bank, whether it's final payment at a closing or what. The triggering mechanism under this law is when the contractor has been paid. They've got to pay their sub within 10 days. So, and that's exactly that's how it works. It's nothing more complicated than that in this legislation. It's just a triggering mechanism, regardless if it was, frankly, if it was a progress payment, but you submitted a bill to the owner based on the plumber's work or the electrician's work, and the bank paid the contractor for that work because it was done, then the contractor simply has to pay the subcontractor within 10 days or final payment at a closing. The triggering mechanism is when the contractor's been paid. They got to pay the sub within 10 days.
Well, Mr. Madam Chair, I thought that when the work by the subcontractor was finished, that's when the days would begin to toll. That's not the nature of this bill?
Mr. Straczynski?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lemmer, what happens most times, and certainly in commercial projects and some larger, I'm sure in residential projects nowadays, is that there could be progress payments, there could be a variety of structures for it, but typically the subcontractor would do work, submit the bill to the general contractor. The general contractor basically submits it to the financing source for payment based on the work that's already been completed. Doesn't affect anybody who hasn't done work. So then that contractor then will be paid on the work by the lending institution or the homeowner if it's a remodeling project and they're paying for it out of pocket. All this bill then takes effect is once that happens, the contractor gets the money, they now got to pay the sub within 10 days, or you have some remedies here, which is legal fees and whatever you can go after, which there's no remedies there now. There's no protections currently, and that's what this does. There's some pretty strong sanctions. It seems to be working pretty well on the commercial side and larger residential units, so we're just trying to make it a little bit easier for everybody.
Madam Chair, one question
Lemmer.
Ahead. When one is, let's say it's a prolonged addition on a house. Let's say it took 5 months to add this addition onto the house. And during the time period after a contract had been established, the prices change. In today's market, the prices kind of go down rather than up, even though material costs go up, further exacerbating the situation of the builder. The closing finally comes along, and the builder in this case isn't making profit. The builder is losing money. And so now you have a situation where the builder is in a bad situation, but now he's in an even worse situation, even if he had the opportunity to either work out an arrangement for payment or to maybe delay waiting another project. Most contractors have more than one project going on at one time. So perhaps there's a profit potential maybe a few days down the road, or maybe it's a couple months down the road. Does this bill account for any flexibility? I don't think it may.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, my bill is just striking some current language. It's not setting up a new structure. The subcontractors have the right to prompt payment on anything except residential and 12 units or less. Mm-hmm. So for every other project they might work on, and they certainly work on other, you know, kinds of projects, commercial projects, for example, they have the right to prompt payment.
Right.
So I don't know why that situation couldn't occur in that world as well. And I'm sure it does. But the point is they've done the work and they've earned,
Madam Chair,
the right to collect.
In
the real world, sometimes plans don't go along as well as one originally plans. And the best intention of a contractor, perhaps there's no money left, and he actually owes money, even more deeper than what he had ever dreamed to even break even. What happens then? And that has happened in the last probably 1 to 2 years often. Now, what happens in a situation like that? This goes into effect. Certain sanctions go into effect, correct?
Mm-hmm. Senator Lemmer, Senator Scheid's bill doesn't do anything to current law. It just takes out the exemptions. So Senator Scheid is not proposing any additional sanctions, anything new. So I think your issue is we ought to turn that around and say to Senate counsel, or maybe Mr. Straczynski or Ms. Renette, which is that under current law, given your scenario, what are the possible responses or what would be the consequences under current law?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, you can't be all things to all people. That's the real-world situation, and it does happen. But I can tell you that when that situation is, remember, the subcontractor also has paid their employees and probably their suppliers along the way, too, so they're injured. I think reasonable people tend to work those kinds of issues out. If one's hurting, the others are going to be hurting as well. I mean, I think they can do that. Nothing, this bill doesn't prevent that. And that's probably what happens most of the time. But at some point in time, if you've been paid for the work that I performed, you simply have to pay me for an undisputed claim. If there was a disagreement or pricing, whatever, it's a disputed claim, this doesn't apply. This is just really simple. It's really straightforward. And I don't think it impacts that at all.
Let's hear from Ms. Frenetti, and then we can continue the discussion if we feel like we need to.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Lisa Frenetti with the Builders Association of Minnesota. First of all, I need to apologize. We had originally supported this bill. We put some language forward that we thought had a little bit more bells and whistles on it. We then discovered from some of our members that were around in 1997 when this proposal was put forward and passed into legislation and state law, the reason why it needed to stay in there. What we feel this does right now is it takes something that agreeably favors the contractor and totally turns it 180 and favors the subcontractor. And we feel that in today's market, and the fact that the housing economy is not doing well, the fact that 5 years ago we had a boom of small builders with a niche market that did some great custom home building here in the state of Minnesota, which is unique to the country, is going to eliminate our guys from being able to come back into the market and get things going again. And what we'd like to do is look to find some balance in this bill to make sure that everybody gets paid when they're supposed to get paid, but everybody gets a little bit out of the bill and out of the language.
Ms. Frenette, I understand what you're saying, but I don't see in the striking out of this language a shift in balance of power. There was an exception carved out in the language.
Let me explain to you real quickly,
okay,
Madam Chair and members, a little bit about construction financing in the residential construction world. And unfortunately, it seems as though it falls on the backs of subcontractors and suppliers sometimes. However, the real rule goes something like this. A developer has a plot of land. They subdivide the land. They have plots out there that can be built on. A home builder goes to the developer and says, I'd like to put some money down on your land. I'd like to put a sign up that says build to suit. And this is one scenario that I'm going to give you. So they put a sign up that says build to suit. A homeowner comes along and says they'd like to have this builder build a custom home for them. The builder, let's say, is a brand new builder to the market. They go to somebody like Lyman Lumber. Lyman Lumber does construction financing. Lyman Lumber lays out terms for this builder as to how flexible they'll be in the terms and how flexible they won't be, whether or not the builder can draw once a month or whether or not they'll get paid upon the closing of the construction finance loan when the mortgage actually starts to get signed and goes through its process. So we look at different scenarios under which construction financing is allowed to happen. And we believe that taking this out and not allowing for our guys to have some sort of terms at all, especially in today's construction financing market when it's more difficult for our guys to get a loan to build and then to be able to dictate some sort of terms to their guys, because our guys don't know what sort of terms they're going to get from the construction financing industry, that we're going to start to edge out the small custom home builder here in the state of Minnesota, which again is a niche, unique market for the state of Minnesota or for the country here in Minnesota.
I don't see that in the stricken language. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Frenette. Again, the reason I don't see this in the stricken language as has been said, I think by the witnesses already, this doesn't come into play until your contractor's actually been paid. And so they're free to follow whatever financing they want and whatever terms they want, because it won't even apply until they get the money under whichever one of those financing scenarios you've described. And then they're just going to have to make sure that within 10 days they've passed that money along. If they're not going to get paid till the end, they won't have to pay anyone else till the end. If they get paid partway through, they just have to make sure they pay the substantive, you know, completed the job with that money they've been paid. So I think it still gives them the same amount of flexibility. But in answer to Senator Limmer's question earlier, you know, what will this do for those contractors that, you know, are experiencing financial hardships? What it will do is make sure that they're careful and that the homeowner, not just the subs, but the homeowner doesn't end up paying the price if they don't financially and responsibly manage the money and pay these subs. Because of all the people involved, it seems to me that the homeowner who pays the price to the contractor shouldn't end up holding the bag because the subs didn't get paid. And the longer you allow them to hold on to the money, the more the likelihood or the possibility that that could happen. I guess that's how I'm looking at this.
And Madam Chair and Senator Olson, with all due respect, and we don't know how our construction financing loan terms are coming out these days. They're writing terms that sometimes are difficult for us to do, and we think it's important for our small home builders to be able to continue to dictate some sort of terms to their subcontractor, which makes it flexible for everybody. And make sure that the custom home builder or the home builder and the subs are getting back to work as quickly as possible, which is what we need here in the state of Minnesota. 5 years ago, the housing economy was driving our market. The housing economy is now doing nothing for our market. And we need to get our guys moving again. And I think by restricting our guys so severely and taking this language, and which agreeably, again, we're agreeing, favored contractors, and now turns it on its head to favor subcontractors, is not going to help us get moving again.
Well, Ms. Frenette, I have tremendous respect for you and the work that you do, and I respect your knowledge in this area. I will reserve some judgment as we move forward. I have to say, and maybe it's because I'm not learned in this area, so I'm looking at the author, and I'm looking around, and I'm having a hard time digging in here and seeing the things you're saying. But Senator Scheid has said that she likes the bill as it is, but she's open to some conversations, and I'm going to rely on her to do that for you. Although I have to say that I'm stretching here. So,
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate it. I want you to know that I have learned more on this topic than I thought I'd ever learn in the past, like, 5 days.
Right. And if anyone else in the audience would like to testify on this bill? Senator Scheid. Oh, sorry. Did you want to testify on this bill?
If I may.
Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is James Sander. I'm a solo practitioner lawyer in Golden Valley, Minnesota. I've been listening to the testimony here concerning this bill. I, too, was involved at the time in 1997 when this bill was originally introduced. I was not the lobbyist at the time, but I was aware of the circumstances under which the language was stricken at the end of the bill. I do want to emphasize that this is a very simple bill, as I believe several members of the committee have already pointed out. It really only levels the playing field. It does not change anything with respect to the project financing or otherwise. I would just tell you that it's in the nature of my practice that I would be the one that would be filing that mechanics lien on a homeowner. That's what I do for a living. I represent subcontractors and material suppliers, so I'm extremely familiar with the kinds of problems that we're dealing with here, and I think it's very important for the members of this committee to be aware that from a day-to-day basis, all construction in Minnesota is really financed by the laborers, the material suppliers, and the subcontractors. The money that comes from a bank later is takeout financing for the credit that these people have extended. That's the reason we have a mechanics lien statute in the state and have since the Civil War, to protect the interests of subcontractors and suppliers. It's also important to remember, with respect to the money flowing through the general contractors, that we already have Minnesota Statutes 514.02, the trust fund statute, which is obligating those general contractors to pay that money through to the subcontractors. And I think this is only one more piece of that puzzle And I believe it was Senator Olson said something about being a homeowner's protection bill. It really is, because it's extremely important for the homeowners to realize and for all the parties in the process to be exchanging the mechanics lien waivers for payments. And I think that this bill would facilitate that process and make it better. It's going to put me out of business, which would be just fine with me. So, all right? Thank you.
Senator Scheid, what is your desire?
Just a moment.
Jim Sander.
Sander, thank you. Madam Chair, I would like to move that Senate File 638 be recommended to pass.
Madam Chair.
On the motion, further discussion. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to introduce an amendment. I didn't have an opportunity to talk to Senator Scheid about it. It's an A1 amendment. I believe there has been a lot of discussion about this bill prior to hearing. There's been attempts by the warring parties involved to come to some type of agreement. And the way it's been characterized to me is that it has come close, but it hasn't come to full fruition. And on request of the Builders Association of Minnesota, I'd like us to consider the amendment before you. One of the questions that I had regarding the bill was why we were changing the number of units of a structure in the original bill. And the amendment that I have before you focuses, I guess we have to flip to the back page first, is putting a better definition on the number of units that would be applicable and that this would focus on residential real estate. 1 to 4 family units is the definition of what a residential property is in the state of Minnesota. It would be falling along with that. Also, HUD guidelines and Fannie Mae guidelines also define family unit residential units as 1 to 4, if my memory serves me correctly. And then it spells out in a little different fashion, perhaps even more specifically, much of what Senator Scheid's bill has in it. It just tweaks the definitions a little bit. And I've was hoping that the representatives from the Builders Association might be able to explain in more detail what this amendment is all about.
Senator Limmer, this is a delete everything amendment.
Yeah, I don't know if I really wanted it to be a delete everything. I talked with the people that were printing it up, and it wasn't really intended to be that way. But unfortunately, it came out that way.
Miss Frenette,
we can.
Madam Chair, members, again, I'm Lisa Frenette with the Builders Association of Minnesota. This is language that, for the most part, 99% was discussed frequently between the Builders Association of Minnesota and subcontractors that have been involved in changing the exemption for residential construction in Senator Scheid's bill. We did not mean for it to be a delete all amendment. We apologize to Kathy, too. We were just kind of working off this quickly when negotiations broke down. What we had tried to discuss was making sure that small builders were not hurt. It's something that I've kind of explained to you guys already. We're concerned about the construction financing terms that are coming down from the lenders, whether they be a Lyman Lumber Company or whether they be a bank, and how they're going to dictate them to us. And then what we might be able to do to get the economy back going again, and then to allow us to have some flexibility. So what we had done was we had brought this down to we took out the portion where it says it's construction of or improvements to the attached single-family dwellings if those dwellings are used for residential purposes and have fewer than 13 units per structure, and left it at Minnesota Statutes 326B.802. And Minnesota Statutes 326B.802 specifically go like this. If you look under on page two, line six, residential real estate means a new or existing building constructed for habitation by 1 to 4 families and includes detached garages. So rather than 13 units or less, we have four units or less, which discusses, again, clearly the small custom home builder. And then the new language down below would allow us to continue to provide for a contract between a contractor and a subcontractor and dictate terms, because, again, we're concerned about the terms that are coming down and being able to get loans. And if there is no contract, like there are on occasions between a contractor and a subcontractor, then the same provisions apply. And just so that you know, the provisions that are in statute, several statutes throughout Minnesota law, all have the same language, except for they apply to commercial construction or they apply to universities, municipalities, or cities who are building public buildings. We have a unique system here, again, in the state of Minnesota in how we finance the construction of homes, and it allows our small builders who build small custom homes to continue to stay in business. And we're concerned that these guys are going to go out of business and not be able to come back if they can't dictate some sort of terms. We're going to have large construction builders coming in, and people aren't going to have the same option to build homes that they've always had. What we would like is just to be able to dictate our own terms for a contract for four units and under.
Madam Chair.
Foley.
Madam Chair, and I'm sorry I didn't get your name.
Lisa Frenette.
Lisa Frenette. I'm not quite sure who you're trying to protect here, and I know that that's there. I just want to tell you my own experience that I contracted with a builder and got a loan from Twin City Federal, and I had this done all at the same time that I was represented by counsel. And in any event, why this situation, one night I got a call from a subcontractor, and they wanted to know if I had completed the payments, because I drew up papers that periodically I pay a certain portion of it, and all I had to do was to look. So when I'm doing that, then the lien waivers were filed against my property, but of course I was the one that got the shaft. The subcontractor and the contractor didn't have any problem on that. So tell me how in this situation that you're describing would benefit from the homeowner, and how it would benefit to the subcontractor and then the contractor.
Ms. Frenette.
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're asking me to explain how this benefits the homeowner, the contractor, and the subcontractor. And the contractor is going to go to the construction finance lending company, and they're going to ask for a loan. Under the scenario that I gave you, they're looking at a plot of land, they're putting up a sign that says build to suit, they have somebody that comes in, they go to, let's say, Lyman Lumber Company, who offers them dictates terms for them.
I did all of those, though.
Okay, you did all of those. Okay, so then they hire their subcontractors. People come out and do the work. But the contractor and the subcontractor will have some sort of contract, which under this case they're allowed to dictate terms for it. They're allowed to say when you'll get paid and when you won't get paid. You might have a draw if you're a good builder or you're a builder that's had a good reputation with Lyman Lumber, and you'll be able to draw on the 25th of every month, and you'll be able to pay your subcontractors off. If you're a new subcontractor, you might only be able to get paid at closing, and then everybody gets paid at closing. But we're allowed to dictate those terms within the contract to make sure everything's all right. And, again, there may be different construction lending stipulations that we aren't aware of that may happen that make us have to define different terms within our contract. As far as the subcontractor being able to get paid, they have the opportunity to file their pre-lien notices and then to perfect their liens. They have the opportunity to go straight to the construction finance company to get paid. Through the mechanics lien statutes, it's against the law for a contractor not to put forward to the subcontractor who the construction lending finance agency is. And if they can't get that information, they're allowed reasonable damages and attorney's fees. So subcontractors have got recourse, especially if they file their liens and perfect them. their pre-liens and then perfect them.
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I do not support the amendment, and I said I would be willing to continue conversation, but what I'm trying to do is level the playing field, and I think that Senators Foley and Olson have explained that this also has to do very much with the homeowner, and they shouldn't be put in the position of, frankly, paying twice for work that's been done. And Ms. Frenette talked about dictating the terms. I don't think there's anything here that says you can't have terms that say when you'll be paid. It's just when the work is done and the bill is submitted, and it would be according to the contract that you've got with the contractor, if you're the sub, that within 10 days you should be paid. I don't think I understand this dictating terms. It sounds pretty heavy-handed, and I don't think that takes into consideration at all the homeowner and what position they're in when subcontractors aren't paid.
Well,
I'd ask the committee to reject the amendment, but with the understanding that I'm still going to talk about concerns here.
Something that maybe, Madam Chair, may I? Something that maybe should be considered then is, if we're going to move along and discuss this, is how do we indemnify the homeowner and the general contractor from a subcontractor who doesn't pay his subcontractors when they've been paid? I mean, there's kind of a vicious chain of command and circle that happens here, and so there's lots of considerations.
Senator Limmer has offered the A1 amendment. Any further discussions on the A1 amendment? All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Ms. Frenette did make an interesting statement. Is there any protection for the subcontractor of a subcontractor to have the same assurance of being paid as does a general contractor hiring a subcontractor in this bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, as I read the language, it says the contract shall be deemed to require the prime contractor and all subcontractors to promptly pay any subcontractor or material supplier. So I think that it's there.
All right.
And it's hard to keep going back and reading. You know, it's current law, and so it's like, well, that's not my bill, but because I know what the bill does. But, of course, it's part of the language here. So.
And, Senator Scheid, Ms. Frenette has raised, I think her primary concern is how do we give some consideration to those small general contractors. So you'll have a conversation with her about that subject.
Madam Chair, yes, as I've said, absolutely.
Very good, because we're friends of contractors, so we just want to make that clear.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, on Senator Scheid's motion.
Okay.
On Senator Scheid's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you,
Chair.
Senator
Thank
Scheid.
You.
Senator Saltzman. Senator Saltzman is here on Senate File 170. I believe that the next package of bills is part of a larger group of bills that's part of a package called the Homeowners Protection Act. Senator Saltzman, Senate File 170.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and members of this committee. This bill is a very simple bill, but it has a tremendous impact on homeowners. And it's often called the attorney's fees bill because it is perceived as being all about attorney's fees, which it is, but it's also something to incentivize a more rapid conclusion to homeowners who are having some very extreme difficult problems in having repairs made with either a new home warranty or a home improvement warranty. And so the intent of this bill is not to send more of these cases to our courts, but as an incentive for builders and homeowners and their insurance companies to settle faster if the threat of a construction company and their insurance companies would have to be awarded and pay the reasonable attorney's fees. Now, I did just note that in the previous bill, in the A1 amendment, that there was that there is language of including reasonable attorney's fees incurred in bringing action with subcontractors. And this is a similar issue with a homeowner. And I have with me today some folks to talk about that. And I think their stories really, really address the problem of people who are basically, in some cases, losing their homes because the repairs cannot be made. And what's important to note is that even when these are settled, which many times they are, the homeowner has incurred attorney's fees that are essentially equal to the cost of the repair, or even 50% of the repair. And so anything that they are awarded, they have to really, repay all their attorney's fees. So it's really something where this is a fairness issue. And again, it's not to put more of these cases in the courts, but really to make sure that they are settled faster and more fair. So with that, I would like to introduce my first testifier.
Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Scott Andreessen. I'm an attorney in the Twin Cities. And over the past 8 or 9 years, I've represented hundreds of homeowners, maybe 400 or more.
Can you spell your last name?
My last name is spelled A-N-D-R-E-S-E-N.
Andreessen. Yes. Thank you. Please continue.
And over that time frame, in representing those hundreds of homeowners in warranty claims against builders, the same fact pattern generally plays out, and it goes something like this. The homeowner discovers that they have a problem with their house, and all of you have probably seen in the news and on TV the problems of mold, as they call it. And there aren't a lot of people that necessarily have mold, but they have substantial construction defects in their homes. They contact their builder. And more times than not, their builder is responsive, but tells them, we simply don't have the ability to take care of your problem, either financially, or they say, this is why I have insurance, and I'll turn the matter over to my insurance company. One way or the other, it ends up at their insurance company's door in response to a warranty request by a homeowner. The insurance companies then typically will force lawsuits to be filed because they won't sit down and settle the case unless all of the other subcontractors get joined in the fun. And so now we have a lawsuit, and that lawsuit's going to take somewhere between a year and 2 years to reach conclusion. And homeowners are going to pay somewhere in the neighborhood of $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in attorney's fees to get to the point where they're mediating, where they're sitting down, as our courts require, trying to settle these cases with the builder and their insurance company and the subcontractors, and maybe it's going to cost $150,000 to repair their homes. Well, what happens as the law is currently drafted is there will be a couple different repair estimates, and even if there's consensus on it costing $150,000, there is no consensus generally as between the general contractor and its subcontractors who's responsible ultimately for these problems. Oftentimes, it's just a finger pointing, but the homeowner gets caught up in that, and they also then make the point, look, we agree that it might cost $150,000 for you to fix your house, Mr. Homeowner, but it's going to cost you another $30,000 in attorney's fees to take us to trial, to win. And so therefore, we're not going to pay you $150,000 to settle your case. How about if we offer you $110,000 or $120,000? And me, as counsel for those people, has to advise them, these are the economic realities. You are, in fact, going to have to pay me to try this case. And even if you win, your net result isn't going to be any better than that. And there are appeals and appeals and appeals. So the net result of that fact pattern is the homeowner pays maybe $30,000 in attorney's fees to get to a point where they settle their case for maybe $120,000 and then have to spend $150,000 to fix their home. Homeowner is now out somewhere in the neighborhood of $60,000 because they had a warranty claim. I have had over that same time frame about 10 cases where by happenstance in the contract between the builder and the homeowner, there was an attorney fee provision. And oftentimes it was the builder who put it in there. In those cases, the fact pattern has been remarkably and without exception different. Those cases have settled in, I think the longest one for me took 9 months. They settled with the homeowner paying less money in attorney's fees, and they settled for a greater percentage of the total cost of repair because all sides were faced with the possibility that if this case goes to trial and if the homeowner prevails, the other side will have to pay their attorney's fees. In the bill, House File 638, that was just discussed, there was referenced a number of times, four or five, leveling the playing field. And that bill was about leveling the playing field for subcontractors. And that bill, by the way, was a one-way attorney fee provision for subcontractors only in residential construction. This bill is an attorney fee provision for homeowners in residential construction. It's designed to level the playing field, and I would ask that you support it.
Thank you. And your next testifier, Senator Saltzman.
Thank you. My name's Ed Seifert, and I live in Shoreview. I'm a homeowner, and I'd like to speak in support of the home warranty attorney fees bill. From personal experience, I've learned why this change is needed. My wife and I lived through a home warranty dispute in 2003. We discovered severe water intrusion damage to our house, which the construction companies involved in its construction acknowledged, but blamed on each other, not on us. We hired experts who offered opinions that the damage was due to a combination of construction defects made by these companies. These opinions did not affect the company's response to our situation. Consequently, we began a home warranty lawsuit against these companies, and that's when the games began. Their insurance company lawyers knew well that under current law, we could recover only the cost of fixing our house. They also knew that most homeowners do not have unlimited cash reserves. Consequently, they employed a legal strategy of making the lawsuit expensive for us by deposing as many people as possible, by filing a summary judgment motion with little chance of success, by scheduling mediation sessions and then not seriously participating in the mediation, and on and on and on. A home warranty dispute like ours is in many ways analogous to a taxi ride. Suppose a homeowner has undisputed home construction defects covered by the home warranty statute. If the builder refuses to fix the defects, the homeowner can elect to begin a lawsuit. For the homeowner, when the lawsuit commences, the taxi ride begins. A money meter has begun to run, but it didn't start at $0. It started at the cost of fixing their home. Maybe $150,000, maybe $200,000, maybe more. The money meter begins to run, and the homeowner has accepted the fact that they will take a loss for their efforts. Why? Under the current law, the homeowner can only possibly recover the cost of fixing the house. For the builder, however, there is no running money meter. The builder has an insurance policy that will cover the outcome of the lawsuit. And then there's the insurance company. They, too, have a money meter that has started to run, but unlike the homeowner, their money meter starts at $0. What is the insurance company's goal? Keep their money meter below the cost of fixing the house while simultaneously making the homeowner's money meter increase as rapidly as possible. The higher the homeowner's meter goes, the more likely the homeowner will settle for less, and that keeps the insurance company's fare low. In our case, the insurance company strategy paid off. Before going to trial, we agreed to settle for less than the cost of fixing our house. Here was the bottom line. It cost us about $151,000 to fix our $260,000 house. It cost us about $55,000 in attorney fees and expert fees to recover the settlement. We settled for $130,000. Our loss was about $77,000. If homeowners who prevail in home warranty disputes could recover attorney fees, construction company insurers would settle disputes sooner. This would save homeowners unnecessary litigation costs. Actually, it would save everyone unnecessary litigation costs. But in addition, of equal importance, it would save the homeowners from the stress and aggravation of pursuing lengthy litigation as a means of trying to fix a problem not of their creation.
Thank you. Thank you for your story. So, Mr. Seifert and Mr. Anderson, though, there are good insurance companies out there, right? So, I mean, I understand that you're speaking from the perspective that you may have run into some that are not willing to work with you, but I wouldn't want to to brush all the insurance companies out there with the same brush. And what we're trying to do here is to help in those challenging situations to give you a little bit of assistance. But I wouldn't want us to be making that mistake, because I think there are good operators out there who want to be helpful. So any questions for our two witnesses? Anyone else here who would like to testify either for or against this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Brooke Simpson.
Simpson?
Yes. S-I-M-P-S-O-N.
What's your first name?
Brooke.
Brooke Simpson. Ms. Simpson?
Yes. Hi. Thank you for letting me come up here. I myself am also a homeowner. I lost my house and my business to a fire last February. And we moved back home after the house was rebuilt on the existing foundation. Shortly after moving back home, my two kids and I became very ill. We found out we had elevated levels of carbon monoxide, which prompted the city to come back out. They found sewer gas leaks, natural gas leaks, and then also water problems, which prompted more testing. And we have found that we have a huge mold problem and moisture levels up to 35% in all the walls in my house. Which now I have to take recourse against the contractor because he is not responding to anything. And no matter what way I turn, if I go up against the contractor, I have legal fees, which means I don't rebuild my house. If I do recoup money, then that money goes to the mortgage company, and I still don't have a house. These contractors need to be responsible for doing what they're supposed to, and if they do, they wouldn't have a problem. As well as the insurance companies wouldn't have a problem if they're making sure that the people that they insure are doing things properly. As it stands right now, we are less than a month away from homeless. So this needs to get changed, because even dealing with the insurance part of it, other than the structure itself, every way I turn, I'm out money. I've lost everything. So it... without these getting passed, it allows the contractors to continue to do things that are unethical and get away with it, basically, because, you know, no matter what, you lose. So,
thank you, Ms. Simpson. Senator Lamar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms., could you tell me what
Simpson.
Year,
Simpson.
Ms. Simpson, mm-hmm. what year was your home built?
It was built in 1905. And I spent 2 years prior to the fire remodeling it. And we had the fire, and it had to get completely gutted. And the contractor did not dry out the house or dehumidify it or seal anything up. He just put stuff up over the damage that was there.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Lamar.
Were there building inspectors that came out and inspected the work according to Minnesota law?
Yeah, and since then I have found out that they should have never issued us a certificate of occupancy to move back in the home.
And why was that?
Because of the different codes that were not up to violation. One was the furnace vent was below. The exhaust would come out and go right back into the intake. There's problems with insulation, the way the house... they didn't even apparently look at the moisture levels in the house. I had a professional come out and do a bunch of testing, which is out of my pocket as well, and... there's a whole report of stuff that wasn't done according to law. And that's also the other thing, is if I go up against the city, then I'm still out money as well. So it's kind of, no matter what way I turn,
Madam Chair.
Senator Lamar.
Simpson, when was the repair done? What year? Do you remember?
2008.
Just last year.
Yep, I lost it on February 7th of 2008. Construction was complete July 31st. We moved back home in at the end of August, and we were in the hospital by October 11th.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Simpson. Anyone else?
My name is Steve Palmer.
Palmer?
Yes, P-A-L-M-E-R.
Mr. Palmer, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm a homeowner that was described by the attorney sitting in this seat a few moments ago. 2.5 years, just over 2.5 years, we've been in lawsuit against our builder to get them to honor the home warranty that came with our home. And I could stop right there. I've got a real problem with that. A warranty is supposed to be something that protects you. And when our home was found to have construction defects, to this day, that warranty hasn't meant anything. And it is very similar to other cases. We spent over $40,000, some inspection fees and things like that. We've been in mediation for 11 months. We still don't have any signed documents, although we have agreed to settle. The numbers I can't discuss, but I can tell you that, again, the attorney that testified here earlier presented a very accurate picture. Our numbers are actually up enough on that. We are also going to have to spend tens of twenties of however many thousands to get the home repaired, and we're stuck. We can't not repair the home. Nobody in their right mind would want to buy the home unrepaired. We don't know that we're going to have the money to complete the repair. We've exhausted our savings, our children's college fund, and we've altered our lifestyle to accommodate and borrow just to get to a settlement. And we, too, were kind of forced into that precarious situation of spending another $40,000 to $50,000 to get through a trial where the net outcome, you're obviously better off taking what you can at that point. I can't tell you how stressful this has been to try to be a father, a husband, continue in my work. I've traveled to Washington, D.C. I've met with mayors, senators in Minnesota, in Washington, D.C., members of the House. Nobody has a position of authority. Nobody has a position to help. Our home was not inspected as required, but the city officials tell me there's nothing they can do. The county tells me there's nothing they can do. The Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, they can't do anything. There literally is no entity, city, county, state, federal government, that can help. And we, too, are out an incredible amount of money. I wasn't born with a silver spoon. I put myself through college. Getting my three kids through college is one of my chief goals in life. I don't know that I'm going to have a home in 6 months from now, much less get my kids to college. Ed, myself, and others are testifying here today are among hundreds who have gone through this, and it's just absolutely ridiculous. The bill itself will level the playing field. I'm pretty certain that all parties involved wouldn't be engaging in 11 months of mediation and all these other types of issues. I'm sure if they knew that they were going to pay our legal fees, they wouldn't drag it out over 2.5 years. And simply it would expedite the process. I'm uncertain how much everybody has paid on this, but it has to be at least twice or maybe four times what the home would really cost to have, or the repair cost would be. So I think this is a necessary bill that will prevent situations like this from continuing and ruining families. I ask that you support it. You're in a position to do so and make real change.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And that ends the discussion on the bill. Discussion among them. Are you another homeowner? Are you? Okay. So I'm so sorry. I really appreciate it that you're here. We've heard, you know, at least three different stories. We understand that your stories are probably pretty similar. I have a really full agenda, and I like to have the members be able to go home before 10 tonight. So I apologize, and I thank you for being here. And the record will note that there are a number of homeowners in the audience who are here to support this bill. All right. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chairman, Jocelyn Knoll. I'm a partner at Dorsey & Whitney, and I'm here on at the invitation of the Builders Association of Minnesota. The provision that is before this committee is a provision that has been brought before this committee in years past. And we heard about leveling the playing field. The American rule in this country is that each side pays their attorney's fees except as provided by statute or contract. The American rule levels the playing fields. Everybody's on the same playing field with respect to paying their attorney's fees. Now, Mr. Andreessen testified that in the cases that he's handled, the best cases in terms of getting them settled are when there's been a contract provision with respect to attorney's fees. And that's put some incentive on both parties to settle these cases. I'm assuming that that provision allowed either party to recover attorney's fees. That's not the case with this bill. This bill is one-sided. It says that the homeowner will recover attorney's fees. It takes the discretion totally away from our courts, who are in the best position to decide who's right and who's wrong, and it says that the court must award attorney's fees to the vendee if the vendee is the prevailing party. There is no definition of prevailing party. The courts struggle with this term when there isn't a defined definition for it. What is the prevailing party? I've been on all sides of these cases. Mr. Andreessen said he's handled hundreds of them. I've handled hundreds of them as well. I've been on the homeowner's side. I've been on the builder's side. I've been on the supplier side. I've been on the manufacturer's side. I've served as a mediator. I've served as an arbitrator in these cases. I do not believe that passing an attorney's fees provision and putting it in the homeowner's warranty statute will help these cases settle. If anything, I think it's going to make these cases more difficult to settle. There will be no incentive. And we've heard about the dreaded insurance companies. And as Madam Chairperson, as you said, there are good insurance companies and there are not so good insurance companies. We've heard about homeowners having to pay attorney's fees. We've heard about builders being frustrated. The builders are paying premiums, dollars, for insurance coverage, and they're not able to get that full coverage as a result of these cases. So there's pain on both sides. The level playing field is the American rule. And at least in other statutes where we allow attorney's fees, we let the courts have some discretion in determining whether to award those attorney's fees. For example, the mechanics lien statute. That discretion under this proposed amendment is taken away from the courts. And I don't think that that makes any sense. Thank you.
Thank you. I see somebody else standing up. So I would really appreciate it if you could help get us to where the committee members could discuss. Again, this we're only on our second bill, and we have a long night ahead of us. Thank you very much.
I'll be real quick.
Thanks.
My name is Alan Powell, and I'm the owner of Certified Moisture Testing. I'm not a homeowner with a moisture problem, but I see these problems every day. I'm entering my 10th year of testing homes, and this is all I do. We've tested over 3,500. Because of our experience, I want to enlighten you as to how extreme this problem is. To begin with, 89% of the houses that we test that are under the age of 1999 have moisture issues. 67% of those have damage. Houses built since 2000, 93% of them have moisture issues, with only 20% of them having damage. The closer a house gets to its 10-year anniversary, the greater the damage, and the easier it is for these people to get their claims filed. Having analyzed all these numbers, 47% of the 3,500 homes that we have tested comes out to 1,645 that are able to make a claim against the builder or the builder's insurance. When I first started testing houses, the insurance companies were settling these claims without much of a hassle. As the moisture issues have grown, the quantity and the severity has gotten bad, and so they have done everything. And I know there's good insurance companies, but in most cases, they do everything they can to block the efforts of the homeowner to get these problems settled. It's getting to the point where it doesn't matter how severe the problem is, the homeowner has to get an attorney to process this claim. If the homeowner has an isolated issue on this house, he's looking at a situation where has to hire an attorney to get it fixed, or he does the repairs himself. That kind of goes against the statute of 327A, which warrants the homeowner against these structural issues. It's important that the attorney fees get recoverable. If you stop and think about it, 1,645 people out there are either paying for the repairs of their homes or they're hiring an attorney to take that care of that process. And 1,645 people at $20,000 $32.9 million in the last 10 years used to take care of this claim issue. And if they have to pay up to $60,000, that's $98.7 million. This is astronomical. And it's important that homeowners at least have the right to recover their expense should they prevail in their cases. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. I think that finishes the testimonies. Members, questions on the bill to Senator Saltzman. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Saltzman, I noticed that the key word to your bill is the word must, that we as a legislature are directing the courts that they must award cost disbursements and reasonable attorney fees. I know that I've served on a judiciary committee for 21 years, and I've noticed that the legislature gets very cautious about telling judges specifically what to do. And I was wondering why you may not have used the word may be awarded, leaving it to the discretion of the court to make that decision so that we can further the independent nature of the judiciary.
Senator Saltzman.
On that question, Madam Chair, and Senator Limmer, well, I guess if I looked at your A1 amendment earlier, it also uses the word must be awarded. And to be very frank, I have worked on this bill for almost 2 years. It was introduced in 2007, and there was some pushback, and so I have attempted to work on language that would be able to advance this issue, to be able to keep homeowners whole, so that, again, we could make sure that people who have paid for a home and have these warranties would be able to find justice. And I bring this bill to you with must because I have worked very hard to try to find some language that might be able to address this issue. But I believe that at this point that must is what I believe we need to do, that if you have taken a case all the way, that you've tried to settle a case and it has gone all the way to the courts, and not all, I don't think there are a lot that really go all the way to a trial. And I'll ask Mr. Andreessen to maybe address that. Not very many actually go to a trial. And so that's why I believe that must is very important, because I have searched to find a word. It could be may, and this doesn't really have any teeth in it then. So that would be my response. Mr. Andreessen, I wonder if you could maybe share how many of these cases tend to go all the way to a trial.
Senator Saltzman, I think it's okay. Mr. Andreessen doesn't. I mean, it's either a must or a may. I mean, the court can either have to do it or right. They can. It's a pretty simple bill. Senator Limmer just raised it as an issue.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just going to say on that point, in my experience as an attorney and having talked to other attorneys is, and I think the testifier was right who said that we have some other bills in statute where we have the provisions for attorney's fees that are discretionary. And I think that there's kind of a large disparity in terms of how those are enforced. A lot of times it just depends on, you know, certain judges have different feelings about awarding attorney's fees as compared to other judges. And so a lot of times it depends on which judge you're in front of, whether you might be likely to get those attorney's fees or not, as well, of course, if, you know, maybe certain circumstances about the case. So it really is just a policy question for this committee, I suppose, and, you know, anyone else will be considering this at some point in the legislature, whether we want to make this a uniform protection that's always going to be available, or whether we feel the judiciary should have some more latitude.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, it's more common to use the word shall when you really want that done. either shall or may tend to be the way that my experience
must is that term. Well, Madam Chair, I think the term must is the one that the revisers usually use as opposed to shall. If you have, I mean, it's the term must is the run, but if it's between the word must and may, I can't think, and maybe I can ask counsel, but I can't think of very many places where attorney fees are absolutely required for the prevailing party. There may be some. I am concerned when you make it mandatory, as it is here, that if you have a case that's just about settled, as Ms. Knoll testified, I don't want to have an incentive for somebody to go to trial. You know, when right now we're hearing of all the short budget shortfalls with the courts to add to their workload, you know, just to say, well, we're going to go to trial because we can't get this one issue settled. I think that, you know, I'm more comfortable saying making it permissive, which is not in the statute right now. And if it's not in the statute at all, then the court has usually no authority to do it unless it's in statute or by contract. So I'm happy to make it permissive. I'm frankly very reluctant to make it mandatory.
Well, Senator Betzel, is that a motion or not?
Madam Chair, well, let me ask counsel if she's, Ms. Pontius, if she's aware of areas where, in law, and she may not be, of issues where the prevailing party must be awarded attorney's fees. Are you aware of any?
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I think there are a number of areas where it is mandatory. There's a mixture out
okay.
there.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll move that on page 1, line 10, the word must be deleted and the word may be inserted. And the same thing on page 1, line 18, where it says the owner must, and turn that to may.
Senator Betzel, did you intend for the may to cover just the attorney's fees, or do you also meant for that to cover the cost in disbursements?
Madam Chair, I intended it more for the attorney's fees. I think cost in disbursements is usually a much smaller amount, so. So I think that actually you can get your cost in disbursements if you're the prevailing party. It's the attorney's fees that's usually permissive.
Senator Betzel, I think Senator Saltzman raised the issue that if you make it anything but a must, it sort of loses its compelling teeth to get the people to the table. As a practitioner, as a lawyer, are you?
It may be awarded.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer?
To that point, sometimes there may be mitigating circumstances or other situations that enter into the court decision that may not rise to an out-and-out breach of building code, and we don't know what that would be, but having the word must may hamper the court in coming to a proper decision, or for that matter, perhaps the award may not be appropriate as well. So giving it to the courts to decide and giving them the discretion, I think, I feel more comfortable with that. I think it's more in the tradition of what the legislature does.
Madam Chair? Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, there might be a compromise middle ground. Sometimes if there's something we want to encourage the courts to do or send a message that, you know, that would be the normal policy, but we want to allow for those special kinds of circumstances, we say something like the courts, you know, must do this unless the court sets forth specific findings why the award would not be appropriate. You know, we do that in...
Well, I think Senator Saltzman's intent here is to never have this get to the court. I mean, the issue here is that I think it's been pretty difficult to have an agreement, and you're dealing with an imbalance of power. And so I think that Senator Betzel's amendment is thoughtful, but I think that this amendment actually will get them to court will do more, will create more work for the judiciary than if you put a hard, bright line in the law and people have to evaluate whether they want to go all over to the court and risk this or settle early. So, Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I'd have to reword the amendment, but just on your last point, I don't know how parties react. I think if you've got everything settled but the attorney's fees, and you know, and the homeowners, frankly, who have incurred costs along the way, say, you know, I don't care. I'm going to go to trial because I want those attorney's fees. That doesn't make sense either. I don't think, and I think that there are people, frankly, that you know will fight over things like that. But the motion, I think, would have to be. Let me withdraw what I had said because it would.
Senator Betzel withdraws his motion.
Yeah, where it would be on page 1, line 10. It says the vendee must also be awarded the vendee's costs and disbursements. So delete the second comma and insert an and. And then at the end of the lines, and may also be awarded attorney's fees. Reasonable attorney fees is on line 111. May also be awarded at the end of 110. And then on line 1.18, the second comma would be deleted and the word and inserted. So it would be costs and disbursements on 119. And then after the word and on 119, may be awarded, and say reasonable attorney's fees.
Senator Saltzman, I have to say that I often say in the committee that English is my second language, but I think my English teacher would be very upset with me with the way the sentence is structured because it's a little bit passive in the way that it's written and makes it hard to read. That being said, though, Senator Betzel has moved that language. What do you think?
I would prefer not to accept that.
So Senator Saltzman is opposed to the amendment.
To oppose the amendment.
Okay. Any further discussions from members? Senator Foley?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think this is an extremely egregious situation and that anyone that would develop this kind of conduct, why they certainly are entitled to the maximum penalties.
On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The motion does not prevail.
Division, Madam Chair. Division.
Division. I think I have good ears. Those in support of the amendment, please raise your hands. Those opposing, please raise your hand. The amendment does not prevail.
I'm sure I heard one more voice here.
Good ears.
All right.
Senator Higgin.
I would move the bill.
Senator Foley moves that Senate File 170 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Senator Foley has a family commitment, so we're going to move her up on the agenda. Senator Foley. Senator Saltzman, two bills, two nights in a row, and we got you out of here. Go forth and spread the word.
Thank you, and today was just as much fun as last night.
Oh, no. We can do better.
This is the first time in this committee.
Second time. First time was last night. But this is Senator Foley's first time in the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have a little family, a son playing in a basketball sectional game tonight, and as the clock was ticking, I was thinking, oh, and I'm surprising him in Rogers at the game, so I really appreciate you moving me up for this bill.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lemmer?
Just for the benefit of the committee, is this Senator Foley's first
time? Yes, it is.
Indeed, it is.
Before the historic judiciary committees?
Senator Phoebe, just for your own benefit, Senator Limmer is the official hazer on the Judiciary Committee.
No, Madam Chair.
I understood that that's
and he never
not legal.
Stops,
oh, and Senator Betzel is next in line. Okay. They fight each other for that title.
Madam Chair, we want first-time members to remember the experience.
Okay. As I mentioned, Senator Phoebe, welcome to the committee. Please present your bill.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And luckily, this isn't my absolute first bill that I've been before committee on, so I appreciate the time with you today. I'm here on behalf of Senate File 264, and this also falls under our homeowner consumer protection bills tonight that were with this bill trying to extend the notification timeline. This would allow a homeowner a full year instead of current law, which allows 6 months for a homeowner to report alleged damage back to the builder or home improvement contractor. And before I get in, I actually was interested in this bill because I have some personal experience with this. So before I get into my personal story with it, I'm going to ask Mr. Andreessen to say a little bit more about the bill.
Mr. Andreessen, and Ms. Andreessen, we've had a number of lawyers come to testify in the committee, and I'm not saying you're going to do this, but I just want to let you know that the lawyers tend to make us really, really late. So to the degree that you can help us, it would make us feel very, very good towards lawyers before the Judiciary Committee.
Madam Chair, and it doesn't mean that my people testifying have to get hazed, right?
No.
Okay.
That's right.
But they will be.
Mr. Andreessen.
We'll be the judges.
Madam Chair and committee, I have no problem with the hazing. I will be very brief, in fact, probably as brief as you could imagine, and that is to simply say, as I understand Senator Phoebe's story, her story will tell you the point of the bill. And the point of the bill is really just, we live in Minnesota, and a six-month notice provision. This is just extending it to 1 year because I can't tell you how many times I've had homeowners say to me, hey, I saw something in the fall. I didn't think anything of it. In the spring, it happened again, and guess what? Spring was 7 months later. With that, I will leave it to Senator Phoebe to tell you her story.
Senator Phoebe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, Mr. Andreessen. My story is pretty simple. I live in a big old house, a big old log home built in the 50s. And over the last 12 years, it's become an absolute money pit, and we've remodeled most of it and redone a lot of it, and which you do with big old log homes. It had a cedar shake roof that had been on since it was built, so 50-some years old, and never had leaked. The roof had never leaked. The shingles had seen their day, and we decided it was time to put a new roof on, and went to a steel roof, and in the same time wanted to work, you know, renew our chimneys, all this good stuff with our home. So we did. Construction on that was complete around the end of September. Huge rainfall came. Saw a little of what we thought might be a leak in the foyer, but just we're busy people, you know. I'm going to basketball games all the time. Winter's here. Didn't really pay attention. My husband and I kind of thought, oh, whatever, we just noticed it. Actually, we live in a small town, ran into our contractor person and mentioned it to him briefly and in passing and thought maybe there might be an issue here. Fast forward, tough winter, everything freezes, no more signs of anything. An extremely wet spring, our foyer's a mess. It's now March. Construction ended in September. We probably peaked at this the end of September. So there we have the 6 months. We're pretty active, I would say, astute people. We like to get things done quickly. We like our home. I was hosting a wedding in my house this June when all this happened. I've got now black mold growing out of the roof. You know, when insulation freezes, it doesn't let the water through, and then when it thaws in the spring, it... So still the roof has not been fixed. The foyer, we've been through the wedding, we went through a graduation, and we're still trying to resolve this situation. And it's been, we have hired an attorney at this point, so we have multiple attorney fees and a lot more details going into it, but the whole six-month thing, if nothing else, like Mr. Andreessen said, we have seasons in Minnesota. We need at least a year for the homeowner's protection.
Good enough. Senator Higgins?
I'll move the bill.
We have somebody who would like to testify against the bill, but hang on.
Give him a fair trial, then you hang on.
Ms. Frenette, you might as well just stay in that seat.
Madam Chair, members, Lisa Frenette with the Builders Association of Minnesota. If I stay in the seat, I can't pace back and forth because it's Lisa Frenette Day in Judiciary. Senator Fobey. We oppose this bill on the grounds that we understand Senator Fobey's problem and that other people have alleged damages like this, but it doesn't encourage people when they find a problem, say some condensation on a window or around the lining of the window, to call as soon as possible to get it fixed. In cases like that, it just exacerbates itself and makes it worse, and we can't get out and fix it sooner. And before you know it, you've got a worse problem. If you're waiting, you know, in the fall, you've got condensation, the window lining starts to crack, mold starts to grow. They wait a whole winter season. Spring comes, maybe it kind of dries up a little bit, but the rainy season comes, it gets worse, and before you know it, it's a worse problem than you've already got, and we really would like to encourage people to call their contractor as soon as they see a little problem and have us come out right away rather than wait for something again to exacerbate itself.
Thank you. Thank you for your input. Any other questions? Senator Higgins renews her motion that Senate File 264 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Senator Limmer and Senator Betzel.
Welcome
We're way
back.
Too easy on you.
We'll see you next time.
Yeah. We're not done yet.
Yeah, next time bring a bill that's more than one word.
Yeah, yeah.
Two words. Senator Dahl.
Oh, another new one.
On that note, Senator Dahl is kind of nervous about coming to the table.
Oh.
Who meet?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this might be my first one as well, but
you would know it.
I think so. Yeah.
You'd know it.
Are you an attorney?
I will also be brief. Sorry.
Are you an attorney?
No, I'm not.
Oh.
He's a school teacher.
You have before you Senate File 362, and I'll be very brief in telling you what this bill does, and actually is quite a bit related to the one you just heard. Right now, under 327A, a homeowner may not bring a warranty claim if the homeowner has failed to provide written notice within, perhaps it'll be longer than 6 months, after the homeowner discovered or should have discovered any loss or damage. This proposal would get rid of the requirement that the notice be in writing when actual notice would have been sufficient. And I think, Rob, I'll let you introduce yourself, and he has an example of how this has played out.
Good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me to come. My name is first initial J. Robert Keenan. I am an attorney. I wanted to come.
I'm sorry. Can you spell your last
Certainly.
Name?
Certainly. My last name is spelled K-E-E-N-A.
Keenan.
Keena, yep.
Please proceed.
Thank you for the opportunity to come today. The reason I'm here is because I, like Mr. Andreessen, who was testifying earlier, I represent many, many homeowners who are faced with this problem. And I have a specific case that has always haunted me, and that's a case of called Collins v. Buse. It's a case that went to the Court of Appeals. And in that case, Dr. Collins, who's elderly, discovered water damage in his home, significant water damage. It's going to cost tens of thousands of dollars to repair. And he called his builder, and it's significant that the Builders Association representative said, we want them to call right away. Well, in fact, calling wasn't enough for Dr. Collins. And what happened with him is he called his builder came out, his insurer brought an engineer out, and they examined the home in the fall, and they spent a good deal of time looking at it, and they said, let's take a look at this in the spring. They examined it in the spring, and they said to themselves, boy, this is a serious issue. And then all of a sudden they realized that the six-month notice period had passed. They'd met at the home. They talked about it. They'd opened the house up. Everybody knew there was damage. Everybody had actual notice. But guess what? When we brought the claim, Not only did the district court have to dismiss the claim for lack of written notice, but also the Court of Appeals affirmed that. And it was a bizarre situation because Dr. Collins, the insurer, came out and interviewed Dr. Collins and recorded his statement. So they had a recorded transcript of what he had said, but it still didn't satisfy this notice requirement. And I said to the Court of Appeals, what happens if you are blind? What happens if you are illiterate? What happens if you don't speak English and you can't write a letter? What do you do in that circumstance? And they said essentially to me, well, that's a problem with the statute. And so I'm just hopeful that you can correct this, because it's not a matter of calling your builder in Minnesota and having the builder come out and look at your home and things like that, because if you don't write this letter, then your claim is absolutely time bar. You get nothing.
Well, Senator Betzel.
I'm sure, and I'm sorry, I didn't get the witness's name.
Keenan.
Yeah, thank you.
Keenan.
St. Paul Irish name.
Keenan.
Madam Chair, Mr. Keenan, it seems to me, though, that written notice serves a purpose. If we just strike the word written out and just say there has to be notice, that could be oral notice, and then you're really running into a proof problem. I mean, the situation you're describing to me suggests that in that case, the vendor had actual notice of the problem. So if you have a situation where there's actual notice, because the vendor's been out there, they've seen it, they've taken pictures, they've written stuff down, maybe the approach to be would be to amend the statute to say that, you know, when the vendor has actual notice, then you don't have to have that letter. But I think the public policy is such that we want people not only to contact their vendors, but you as an attorney can appreciate you should do things in writing. And, you know, if you don't do things in writing, we have proof problems all over the place. I think you're going to create, I mean, you know, we try not to, you know, change a whole body of law based upon one incident. I mean, obviously, when things come to our attention. But I think that the bill goes way too far the other direction when there might be a better way to handle this to describe the situation that you just mentioned to us.
If I could address that, just to say, I encounter people who are faced with this situation every single month. I've encountered at least 50 people who are forced to deal with the fact that they have no warranty claim for six-figure claims. But that said, here's the problem. When you call your builder and your builder comes out and meets with you and you discuss with them, it's kind of against human nature to then write them a letter. So it's when they know the builder and they call the builder and there's actual knowledge and they meet with the builder, you don't say to yourself, now that I've met with them at my home, I'm going to follow up with the letter. It's because of the fact that in Minnesota we're nice people. When the builder comes out and talks to us and we know they know, that we no longer feel compelled to write the letter, and that's when we lose.
Well, Mr. Keena, though, Senator Betzel makes a good suggestion that the actual notice, doesn't that respond to exactly the situation that you're talking about, that it's actually broader, whether that notice is relational or oral or telephone call or written notice, that so long as there's a proof process in place that there's been some actual notice, that I think it's actually broader than just being silent.
And I perceive the way it's written right now to require actual notice. I think that it says notice, so it's not constructive notice. It's notice.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Keenan, if we change the statute, the courts are going to assume we had a reason to do so. If we just strike the word written, it seems to me somebody down the road can say, I made a phone call. That is sufficient. And then you have proof problems. Was the phone call made or not? The response that you just gave a minute ago, that if the people come out, was exactly the thing I said. If there's actual notice, if you've called them and they came out and saw the place, I think you've made that. But if all that was done is now having a proof problem, did I call them or didn't I call them, and you've got nothing else, I think we've created a whole nightmare here. So I think that the bill as it's drafted could create more problems.
I think under that circumstance, you'd have a fact issue for the court, and the court would then evaluate it as a fact issue. And if the court found that reasonable minds could not differ, that there was no notice, they could dismiss in that circumstance. Yeah. But with the fact issue, it's like the other burdens that the plaintiffs carry.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Keenan, and I'm a lawyer, too,
yeah,
by the way.
I know that.
I think that our responsibility
is to pass laws that are clear to the citizens of the state of Minnesota and not kick everything into the courts and have them figure out what we meant.
Right. I think that
gentlemen,
that, what's
Mr. Keena, Mr.
Sorry.
Keena, you have to let me call on
I
you.
I apologize.
Otherwise, we will have chaos. So let me interrupt by saying that Ms. Pontius says that all this argument about the front page may not be as helpful as if we were to look at the exclusion section in Section 2. And the reason why it is merely just a striking of in writing is that if we were to incorporate the actual notice concept, Senator Betzel, that sub A may have to be rewritten, which doesn't mean that it can't be done. But I just want to point that out to you, Ms.
Madam Chair, which lines are you looking at?
2.11 through 2.13.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
That section is the same as Senator Phoebe's bill that we just looked at.
We just amended it.
Same thing
that
we
12 months.
Just amended it. So as we proceed, we probably want to change 6 months to 12 months in this one as well, or delete this section.
They can get engrossed together.
The revisor would catch.
Senator Higgins, I think that they're going to get engrossed if they pass, they'll get engrossed together. So they change separate words that are next to each other.
Yeah, and then, Madam Chair, the effective date is written differently as well.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Maybe, again, I'm trying to read through the exclusions, but where within the exclusions does it say that, you know, if the vendor, you know, has the actual knowledge, you know, and as I say, I'm trying to read through the Section 2 to find out if the vendor has actual knowledge, which clearly if they've been back at the property, they've seen it, they've taken the photos, they've you know, made the write-ups, they clearly would know. I don't know what the exclusions say exactly that, so I don't know. I mean, it says if the let's see, not reported within 6 months after the vendee or the owner. I don't know that 211 to 213 actually deals with that situation.
So, Senator Betzel, you think that just by striking in writing but inserting actual notice in the front page, that still gives you the right combination?
Well, first of all, Madam Chair, I'm concerned about striking in writing. I think that it is still prudent to always, if you've got a problem, put it in writing. And it could be an email, but it should be in writing. However, maybe the exclusion could be that if the vendor has the actual notice of the damage, then that would be an exclusion under 327A.03. But I still believe that in writing serves a legitimate purpose, and there just may be situations which, when it's not needed, but that is why 327A03 would apply.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, when you're looking at written and notice on there and the stricken written, would it be appropriate to insert the word actual in where the written is, and would that be any more appropriate to cover the
word
actual versus Senator Betzel?
Chair, Senator Foley, I don't know if that quite works because it talks about the vendor's receipt of written notice. I don't know how the vendor receives actual notice. I mean, the vendor might have actual notice. So I think grammatically it might be able to be worked in there. I don't know. We can just drop the words in and make them fit. But, you know, as I say, I personally think that the way to do this would be to leave Section 1 as it is and just add an exclusion to Section 2 to deal with the scenario that we had brought to us.
Senator Dahl, I think that the members of the committee want to work with you to make this. I mean, this is a recognition that we want to address the issue raised by Mr. Keena, but we want to do it in a way that we're not creating a bigger problem. I'm going to temporarily lay your bill on the table and let Senator Betzel and you, we're going to move on to the next bill, but why don't you and Mr. Keena talk to Senator Betzel and Senate Counsel to see if you can come up with some language that we might put in the bill to make it work.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Just as a little history, in 2006 we put this into law and recognized notice as written as the appropriate method to bring a message. At least that's how I was described by my researcher. And I remember the debate, but the debate is very similar to what it is today. It's just that the players are reversed and that builders were confused, when does notice begin? Mm-hmm. And we thought at that time that perhaps written is the best way. It gives a time certain point to get the clock moving. And so I just wanted to add that into this discussion.
Madam Chair?
This law isn't that old.
Senator Higgins?
Go ahead. Then
Mr. Keenan.
Go on to the next subject.
I think that you may be confusing the law with regard to the notice and the written notice between the builder for an opportunity to repair. That was the opportunity to repair law that occurred in 2006. This law, this written six-month notice law, has been in place for many years.
Okay.
I've been instructed differently.
Senator Higgins.
I'm curious as to whether an email would be considered written notice or an electronic message of
communication.
Yeah.
So that will be incorporated into the conversation as you talk about it. We would. You want to testify on the whole bill, or do you want to give input on this? Then you can join the circle over there at that corner for conversation. Thank you. We're going to temporarily lay this on the table for a discussion, and we're going to look at deal with Senate File 470, Senator Rummel's bill. Senator Rummel, Senator Limmer wants to know if this is your first time in the Judiciary Committee.
The Judiciary Committee.
Yes.
Okay.
Ooh. This year.
Good.
Did we have bisphenol A and some of those things in here?
I don't think I had that in this committee.
No?
So
she would have remembered.
Wow.
Let's see. Why don't I talk to Kathy and see if I can get some.
Madam Chair, and I hope that Senator Betzel can stay at the table just.
Senator Rummel, please proceed.
Madam Chair and committee members, this bill refers to an amendment Senator Betzel made, and I'm hoping he will stay at the table long enough to see if I have the history correct.
He's listening.
Okay. This bill is a small bill to restore the legislative intent to a 2004 amendment to Statute 241.051, Subdivision 4. As I understand it, before 2004, there was no end certain date for warranties on buildings. In 2004, Senator Betzel introduced a bill that would put an end certain date. And as I understand it, there would be 12 years for a homeowner to take action on the warranty on their house. The intent of Senator Betzel's amendment was not to shorten the warranty, but to provide a reasonable time from the end of that 10 years so that the homeowner could bring action. So the legislative intent on the amendment or the bill was 12 years, and this bill actually makes that clearer. I have with me Scott Anderson, who can answer any technical questions because, unlike so many of you, I'm not a lawyer. And then with me, I have Floyd Raddick, who can tell his story, if that's permissible.
Good. Welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record.
My name is Floyd Raddick.
Raddick?
R-A-D-A-C-H.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's my first time, too.
What treat you nice?
Thank
sir.
You.
Yeah. He's a constituent. We always treat constituents well.
Well, are you Senator Rummel's constituent?
Yep, mine.
Or Senator Limmer's constituent?
No. In either case.
Please proceed.
My name is Floyd Raddick, and I'm here to testify on behalf of Prairie Creek Townhouse Association. Our development is located in Chanhassen, Minnesota. And we're requesting your support of Senate Bill 470, which has already been outlined to clarify the 12-year statute of limitations. Prairie Creek Townhouse Development has 24 Rambler-type townhouses of stucco and brick construction, which were built and sold in the mid to late 1990s. 75% of our occupants are retired and living on fixed incomes. In early 2007, a water intrusion problem was discovered in one of our units. We hired a professional engineering firm who concluded that numerous construction defects existed, none of which were discovered by the building inspector. The potential damage is believed to be present in all of the units, although varying from one unit to the next. The estimated total cost for the 24 units to be repaired is at $2.4 million, or on average $100,000 per unit. We currently have a lawsuit pending against the builder. When the lawsuit began, it was our understanding that we had a 12-year period in which to bring construction warranty claims against the builder for our homes, who incidentally has gone out of business. However, the judge has recently dismissed 10 of the 24 homes in our development because our recent Court of Appeals case, our lawyer tells us, improperly interpreted the warranty statute to have a 10-year limitation. Under this interpretation, we have units in the building constructed at the same time, where one unit may qualify under the current lawsuit and the other two are excluded, where the two buildings or the entire building was put up at exactly the same time. It is not, if this is not favorably addressed in the current legislative session, the estimated cost for our homeowners will be an additional $1 million for the repairs to be completed. Senate Bill 470 would clarify that the ultimate statute of limitation period for a builder is 12 years, which we understand was the legislative intent back in 2004. It is our understanding that this bill, if favorably addressed, would apply to all suits currently in progress, and therefore our 10 units which are presently excluded would then be included in the lawsuit, obviously having a very immediate impact on us. I would also like to note that at the time of the purchase of these units, there was no statute of limitation in effect. So we purchased the unit without a statute of limitation consideration. Again, nearly 75% of our unit owners are essentially retired from the workforce and living on fixed incomes. Failure to favorably consider this bill could result in non-repair of many of the units and ultimately the loss of a home. While homeowners should be responsible for normal maintenance of these homes, these issues are clearly related to construction defects and not the fault of the homeowner. Your support of this bill will substantially impact the association's ability to address these issues and provide some assurance that individuals will not lose their homes. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Romo, do you have another testifier?
No, but I have Mr. Anderson here in case you have technical questions that I cannot answer.
Very good. Any questions for Senator Romo?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Sir, I didn't get your name.
Raddick? Floyd, first name
right.
Floyd?
Mr. Raddick, was this damage caused by a leaky roof? Is that?
Well, there were numerous construction defects. I'm sorry.
That's right, Mr. Raddick.
There were numerous construction defects, but we think the principal problem is that the windows were improperly installed so that the moisture drained into the wall cavity rather than out from the wall cavity. But there are other issues that also were discovered by the professional engineer.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair and Mr. Raddick, the way, or maybe anyone else at the table, if we pass this, does this basically create a kind of a lifetime warranty for as long as these windows have been installed? You have to have a stand behind some type of implied warranty that the contractor will repair at any time?
Ms. Andreessen?
Senator Limmer, Chair, no, it does not. In fact, what it does is the purpose of this is simply to clarify there is an end date, and that end date is 12 years, period. You have to bring a lawsuit under the warranty statute within 12 years of substantial of the warranty date, and the only reason it's necessary is because in the bill in 2004, prior to 2004, as Senator Rummel said, there was no end date. We had the situation you just described. 50-year-old homes could have a warranty, which even the most pro-consumer person in the room would acknowledge that that doesn't make any sense. It's our understanding that the intent was to put in a 12-year end date. It's just the way it was drafted. It has been interpreted in such a way by the court, by at least one court anyways, to say that you have to discover the breach of the warranty within 10 years in order to have a cause of action. And it is only if you discover the breach within 10 years, say the day before the 10 years runs, that you'd get two more years and you might get up to almost 12. That has created a problem because you don't have a cause of action under this statute until a warranty has been breached. A warranty isn't breached until multiple things happen, including discovering the problem, notifying your builder, having the builder return your call or not, or tell you they won't help you. It's only when they tell you they won't help you that there's a breach of that warranty. And the way it's drafted, the court has said that's all got to happen within 10 years or you're out. So in Mr. Raddick's case, what he has is 24 homes where, because people moved in on different dates into a townhouse community, some people, when they all discovered it on the same day. But because some people discovered it at 9 years and 360 days, and some people didn't discover it until 10 years and 16 days, the people who discovered at 10 years and 16 days were thrown out of court. And that, I've read all the transcripts from the House and the Senate side in 04, and that doesn't appear to me to be at all what the intent of the legislation was. This would just say, it's as clear as can be, 12 years, end of story.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemon.
Usually a life of a roof is about 20 years, asphalt roof. I'm just trying to create a scenario. I'm trying to create a scenario that perhaps a roof in year seven, a few shingles blow off in a severe windstorm and creates a puncture in the roof where water can go in. Would the builder have to uphold a warranty in an event like that, according to this?
Ms. Anderson.
If that was caused because of a windstorm, if there was no defect in the way the roof was done, the answer to that question is no. The warranty statute only applies if you can prove there are defects in the workmanship as related to building codes and building standards. So if it's just storm-related damage, that's not a builder's responsibility.
Okay. Ms. Renetti. You want to speak to this? We'd like to hear from you.
I haven't got anything better to do this evening. So
better than pacing back there. So.
I'll be home with my children. Madam Chair, members, I'm Lisa Frenette. I'm with the Builders Association of Minnesota. I have not been privy to the testimony that was taken in 2004, nor have I been privy to what Senator Betzel's intent was. I do know what the statute says. It allows for the warranty to go up to 10 years if it with an extra 2 years for the statute of repose if a homeowner finds an alleged damage in the ninth or the tenth year. Our concern is what do you do with the homeowner that finds it on the last day of the 12th year? And we all know that somebody's going to be upset, and they're going to come back, and they're going to want an extra 2 years to come back. And we're going to extend this on further and further, and we're not going to have any timeline that cuts either the warranty off or the statute of repose off. And it's somewhere along the line we need to start thinking about when we're going to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for our testifiers?
Madam Chair, one Senator other Limmer. Question. Senator Rummel, I noticed on the last line an unusual phrase when it comes to effective date. And then you made the addition of making an application to cases pending or commenced on or after that date. Usually our bills are written that it just goes into effect after enactment, period. Why is that included in that enactment date?
Well, I hope I can answer this correctly.
Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer. As the testifier told you, there are a number of cases in litigation right now. And so in order to deal with his case, we have this kind. Maybe you can explain it better, Mr. Anderson.
Ms. Anderson?
To be brief, I understand your point exactly, and I think the difference is, and this was how it was explained to me by a couple of senators, is that all this bill seeks to do is to clarify the legislative intent originally, to clarify what the law is, and that's the distinction. If it was changing the law or creating a new law, I think then the rule is generally it goes forward in August, starting August of this year. But because this is just a clarification and because it needs to be the improper interpretation of the statute has affected hundreds of people currently, that's why I think it was made to be applicable to pending actions as a clarification.
Ms. Fernandez,
if I may, members, Mr. Andreessen has talked about a clarification in the law and the intent of the law. And I think that there's a difference. And if we're clarifying it, then we move forward. But we don't move backwards. We don't move into anything retroactive. We want to, if it's an actual clarification of the law, you're going to say we're going to move forward from August 1st on.
Madam Chair. Thank you. Senator Olson.
I guess just with all due respect, I guess I would disagree. I would think, and maybe council can help us with this, but because I haven't been here as many years as some people, but I would think that, you know, if we were changing a law, then we would not want to go retroactively normally because there's a change that people haven't been on notice of. But if we're simply clarifying what we intended to do in the first place because someone has misinterpreted our initial intent, then we're not... then it would make sense to be retroactive because in those situations we don't feel we're making a change. We're just making sure that our original intent is followed. I guess that's how I would think it would make sense to me.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I hear that there's testimony out there from 2004 that talks about alleged intent. However, the actual language that was passed is what we have in law right now. So I can't speak to what the intent of what you all discussed in 2004 was. I can speak to what is in statute right now, which is a 10-year warranty with a 2-year statute of repose for a homeowner who comes in the 9th and the 10th year to allow to make sure they have a recovery for the breach of warranty. Or for the breach of contract. I'm saying that wrong. Anyways.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
This introduction of a clarification versus change is an interesting discussion, but I'm not sure if I remember when we had this bill before us years back. The way I'm looking at it, I guess it's in the eyes of the beholder, but I see change here, not clarification. And I think I probably have a whole stack of bills before me that probably could be argued, oh, it's just a clarification. We're just making it clearer. But I don't think the line is real definite between clarification and change on anything we do in the legislature. I think I could stamp rightly change on just about any bill that we get before us. The rules were established prior to this time. I thought the language was relatively clear. The rules of engagement are established. I believe this is change, and I'm troubled by the fact that the legislature now will bring in cases pending in order to definitely put at a different advantage a party in a courtroom. And I get very nervous when the legislature starts going down this path, because then we could do that on just about any civil case that's pending before the legislature. I've even seen it where we've gone back 2, 3, 4 years in the attempt to restore some element of justice to someone that was wronged. And very rarely do we even ever go back to that. It has to be a rather extreme instance.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I just I have to believe, Senator Limmer, reading this through, that we had to have, and I suppose it's easy for me to say this since I wasn't there at the time, but we had to have had just a confusing job of wordsmithing that we're trying to correct here, because otherwise there's no logic behind what we would have been intending to do. As I think has been testified, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense that you'd want someone to have a shorter period of time.
On that note, Senator Olson?
A shorter period of time. Well, maybe it does. I guess maybe if it gets to the 9th or 10th years. But, I mean, it's just real hard for me to understand and confusing. I can't even really understand the language the way it's written. So it just seems to me that this would be more like a clarification.
Senator Olson, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson moves that Senate File 470 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
Madam Chair.
Any further discussion? Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, we had this discussion about clarification versus change. I don't think there's a historical reference to how we deal with effective dates, whether we deal with clarification or change. That's a discussion point that Senator Olson brought forward and maybe made a conclusion to that effect. But I don't think we write our effective dates with this type of language based on whether it's a clarification or change. I don't think we have any history of
Ms.
that.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, it is actually fairly common in statute of limitations bills. I know there have been bills in the past that have actually revived extinguished actions, which you can do constitutionally, even though, you know, maybe raises some concerns, but I've seen it happen quite a bit. So,
quite a bit?
Yes. There's some precedent for it.
On Senator Olson's motion, any further discussions?
Madam Chair, just a question, and maybe I'm getting confused, but yeah, I was heavily involved in trying this because this was a result, I think, of the Gomez case or something, but was this one, and this for Ms. Pontius, Senator Neville we had to circle back and do something again to fix the statute of repose, and I don't remember whether it was this issue or another one at some point. Because we did have to come back at some other point, and Senator Neville handled the cleanup one, and I just don't remember. I don't know if you recall, Ms. Pontius. So.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, I think that may have been, there's a statute of repose, I think, in the statute of limitations for improvements to real property.
Okay.
I think that might have been.
And I think this was part of the problems that we're trying to deal with them. But I remember we passed something, and then the appellate court ruled one way, which was different from what we had intended. Yeah. And so then Senator Neville took a run at it. So we've spent some statute of limitation and statute of repose are not easy.
It's Neville's fault.
Now Judge Neville.
On Senator Olson's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Dahl. Senator Rummel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Madam Chair, by the way, I'll mention to Judge Neville that his name was mentioned today in very kind terms. I see him regularly. But
it's too regular.
We miss him on this committee. He was a very good member of the committee.
But it will affect the success of your next bill.
Yes.
Definitely. Does Senate or the council have the new language?
Senator Dahl, we sent you off to go see if we can get some new language, and that's to Senate File 362. Ms. Pontius, are we ready yet, or should we have?
If I can have another minute.
Another minute. So, Senator Dahl, I'm so sorry. Will you take another brief rest, and we'll do another bill. We'll do Senator. Let me see here. Senator Latz has two bills, and so Senator Latz, do you mind if we do Senator Higgins? One bill.
Oh. You're gasping.
Go ahead. Go. My testifier's not here.
Okay. Well, all right, Senator Latz, Senate File 6.
I don't know. I can't see Latz being quick.
Senator Latz, this is the highest number I've seen in the Judiciary Committee yet. Senate File 6.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 6 would change the, by expanding the categories of damages available to a homeowner when seeking to recover damages is for loss relating to construction defects. The current level of damages are defined in statute. And in fact, limited in statute, more than ordinary contract damages, which are allowed under common law. Unfortunately, as you've heard from testimony from homeowners earlier, those limitations on damages, as a practical matter, force the homeowner into a position of loss at the end of the road, no matter whether they win, lose, or settle. There is no conceivable way for them to recover their total loss under the current damages categories which are allowed. This bill would change that so they could, in fact, recover all of their losses. There are often times when their home is no longer habitable during the repair period, and the homeowner then has to go pay to live somewhere else. Under current law, the cost of living somewhere else is not recoverable as a loss. And there are other damages which might also flow from the construction defect, which are also not recoverable. So I would like to ask Attorney Scott Andreessen to fill in more detail on that.
Mr. Andreessen?
Chair and committee, Scott Andreessen again, and here again, I think I can be very brief. I think Senator Latz has described the bill precisely, and I would just point you back to the story that you heard from the woman sitting behind me earlier today as a for instance. Because of problems in her house that were related to construction defects and the way they vented her home, her and her family got ill as a result. They had to move out as a result of that. There wouldn't even be much debate in her case that they had to move out. Yet under the warranty law as it exists today, she wouldn't be able to recover damages or the cost of living in a hotel or eating a meal instead of being able to cook a meal after going to Cub Foods. This simply takes off the restriction on the damages such that she would be able to allow those damages if they or recover those if they flow from a breach of warranty, and that's what's important. That's the limitation on this. It's only if a court were to find that damages outside of the cost of repair flowed from a breach of the warranty that you would ever have any other damage. So it is very limited because you're going to have to prove it relates to the breach to get the damage. But certainly I would think that the law should protect her if she's forced to move from her home.
Thank you. Ms. Frenette?
Madam Chair, members, I'm Lisa Frenette with the Builders Association of Minnesota, and again, we oppose this bill. First of all, it's subjective. It leaves open for so many things that could possibly have a builder have to pay for. It doesn't put in any sort of timeline. It doesn't discuss what if it's a simple fix? What if it's some windows that need to be replaced? Everything flows into a subjective sense of what the homeowner thinks they want to do or in what's going to happen and how much should be paid. There are also, Mr. Andreessen talks about only if it flows from a breach of warranty. In many cases, these alleged damages and the cases go forward with a breach of contract and with a negligence case also, in which case these people are allowed to recover these damages.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, and the first gentleman, Mr. Andreessen.
Yes, that's correct.
What protection would I have if I were a renter in these situations?
Ms. Andreessen?
Senator Foley, this statute would not provide you any protection at all. It applies to owners of homes. This particular statute
Senator Letts, is that your intention, or are you interested in expanding this legislation to cover what just as difficult for a renter as it would be the owner in many instances?
Senator Letts.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, the current law applies only to homeowners with regard to the breach of warranty protections, and that's all this bill is intended to remedy.
Well, I'm wondering, though, that if the owner has loss of income from the renter, because the renter is now forced to go find housing elsewhere, I would assume that would be part of the eligible damages that could be submitted for reimbursement. Whether it would get paid or not, I guess, would be up to the court, Mr. Anderson.
Chair, if this bill passes, then your assumption is correct. But as the law stands today, those damages would not be recoverable
correct.
Under the statute.
Correct. So the inconvenience to the renters, and I think Senator Foley is very thoughtful in thinking about, oftentimes renters get displaced all the time when we only think about, you know, the parties who are directly involved in the structure. And I think, once again, I think the inconvenience to the renters is not going to be taken into consideration in this instance. So, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Letts. I'm just wondering, and maybe you can help to remind us, because I know that there are a lot of words of art related to damages, different kinds of damages, and depending on which one of those words of art might be attached, it depends how far you can kind of go afield with the how closely related those damages might be to a particular act. And so, for example, like in the situation with the lady who was made sick from the mold in her house, you know, closely related to that would be the cost of having to move out, or maybe even there's a loss in value even of her home, even after it's been repaired, that, you know, would be fairly directly related. But what if she has medical bills related to the mold because this wasn't repaired? Or what if someone loses a job, or maybe they do business, you know? So I guess I'm just thinking that we ought to maybe talk a little bit about those words of art or what your intention would be, because if we just remove this language and leave just damages alone with no qualifiers, we kind of go from a very limited remedy that's available to now, right now, to probably the broadest remedy that would be available. I'm just wondering if we ought to think about whether there's any middle ground there, like direct damages directly arising out of the breach or
reason,
you know, something like that. Just do you have any thoughts about that?
Senator Letts?
Madam Chair, I'll make a brief comment and ask Mr. Anderson to respond. You know, case law has struggled with where do you draw the line on consequential damages from contract actions or breach of warranty actions over the years, and all of those case law limitations would still apply. Ultimately, it would be the finder of fact, I assume, that would, within the structure provided by the case law, that would determine how remote is too remote for damages to be considered to have flown come directly from the breach. Maybe Mr. Anderson can elaborate.
Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, Chair. And Senator Olson, I guess I would say to a point that Senator Letts made earlier, if a homeowner brings a claim for defective construction of their house, the Chapter 327A warranties are one of the causes of action that they have. They would also have a cause of action potentially for, say, negligent design and construction. And in a negligence cause of action, there is no limitation whatsoever on damages. It's all damages proximately caused by the conduct. This actually is a little more limited to that because it specifically says that the damages would have to arise out of the breach. So there has to be a finding that it is, in fact, directly related to the breach, mm-hmm. which is more limiting than in a general, say, negligence or breach of contract claim.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Nancy Emerson. I live at 8750 Concord Court in Inver Grove Heights, Minnesota, 55076. I've been part of the homeowner group for the past 6 years. I was there 2 years ago when we were discussing the previous bill. I just wanted to point out one thing related to Brooke's comment. The Minnesota Department of Health, and this relates to having to leave your home because it's moldy and you might. Minnesota, and I'll give you one for there. They say that if there's mold in home, from the Minnesota Department of Health fact sheet, that people that are infants and children, elderly people, individuals with respiratory conditions or sensitivities such as allergies or asthma, persons having severely weakened immune systems, for example, people with HIV infection and chemotherapy patients, organ transplants, and they should not be living in molding homes. And I know this is one of the, and so Minnesota supports leaving a home if mold is a direct result of that. And I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, Ms. Emerson. Mm-hmm. Any further discussions on Senate File 6?
Well,
Senator Betzel.
In response, you know, following up on Senator Olson's questions and Mr. Andreessen's response, it seems to me that, you know, if somebody's bringing a cause of action for damages arising out of a breach, I'm guessing that the complaint is going to stretch it as far as they can to say that the medical costs I've incurred because there is mold somehow arose out of the breach because you didn't put the right windows in or whatever. Now, it might be a stretch or whatever, but I think the argument's still going to be made, and I think this might still be opening up the area that the statute as it currently is clearly has to be tied to the damages caused in fixing the property. I think by eliminating it, the language as the bill does here, that raises, you know, may raise the questions that we obviously intended many more damages to be included, and I'm just not sure whether that, you know, goes in the other direction to open up to, you know, any conceivable damages as long as somebody can say, well, it was tied to the breach. So I'm not quite sure, and I think that I don't know if that the damages need to be directly related to the breach, reasonable, or whether the language does suffice. I'm not sure, but I'm sure that somebody's going to make an argument that, you know, go as far as it can.
Madam Chair.
I don't know what to, you know.
Senator Latz.
Ultimately, remember, the plaintiff, homeowner, would have to prove the amount of their damages to the satisfaction of the finder of fact. So, you know, whatever they allege in the complaint is one thing, but in the end, they've got to prove it up.
So, natural notice concept is problematic.
Any further discussions?
I'd like to say something again quick. I think Brooke Simpson.
Ms. Simpson, please, yeah, restate your name for the record.
Brooke Simpson. I think with what I've gone through, I think what you guys are kind of all looking for is necessary expenses. And that I know I've gone through with my insurance company. I mean, I'm not trying to recoup, you know, something because I had to go get my daughter something or this or that, but I've lost income from business. I'm paying for a hotel plus a house. I'm paying expenses for here and there. The food alone, my cost to prepare food and from a hotel room is ridiculous, and it pretty much forces us to go out and eat. I mean, it's the expenses that are necessary that need to get reimbursed because, again, no matter what way I go, I'm lost, and if these contractors were doing what they were supposed to, there wouldn't be a need for this.
Any further discussions?
Thank you.
Senator Olson moves that Senate File 6 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. My understanding, you might want to check your notes. I think business, industry, and jobs may have requested this particular bill. I don't know if you've got any record of that.
Who?
We don't go anywhere unless we.
Yeah. Pardon me?
It's not a policy of this committee to go unless they got written notice from the other.
That's why I'm saying I'm not sure, but I wanted to.
I didn't hear you say.
I believe it may be that the Committee on Business, Industry, and Jobs requested this bill. I'm not certain on that, but
I don't think they've requested this bill. On that motion, so the bill will go to the Senate floor. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Lott, Senate File 776. We're not quite yet there yet, Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lott.
Senate File 776 would require that the existing statutory implied residential construction warranties be made as express warranties and provided to the buyer in writing. So the statute already has the warranties in them. They're implied on the construction warranties, but often the buyers don't have that information in front of them in writing, and this would simply give them written notice when they're engaging the contractor of what their warranty rights are.
Ms. Frenette.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Lisa Frenette with the Builders Association of Minnesota. And I guess if you're going to make this an express warranty, let's talk about what express warranties are truly supposed to be. Like as in any express warranty, you get a toaster, you have an express warranty. If your kid sticks something into the toaster and the toaster quits working, you don't get a new toaster. It says so. If the toast doesn't toast in the toaster, you get a new toaster. If you go into your house, I have a 100-year-old house. My husband and I clock around that house every 3 or 4 years because it's our responsibility to make sure the clock stays in shape and water does not leak into the basement. If we're going to talk about express warranties, let's talk really about what the obligation of the homeowner is and what the obligation of the builder is when it comes to a construction defect, because the statutes, or the warranty statute, is ambiguous enough for the homeowner not to understand what their responsibilities might be and what the builder's actual responsibilities are.
Ms. Frenette, is it a little bit different, though, that this looks at the new constructions and new homes as opposed to an older home?
It was an example that I was using, Madam Chair, but homeowners, whether it's a new home or an old home, have responsibilities for taking care of their houses. And express warranties, in all cases that I'm led to believe and understand and have read about, talk about what an owner's responsibility is, regardless of the product, and what the company or the builder's responsibility would be.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I'm just going down another path with my thinking. And what I'm thinking, and again, when you're talking about an area that you didn't really practice in and you think back to law school and you know enough to be dangerous, but you don't necessarily know the answers. So the issue it raises for me is that there's kind of a different body of law around express warranties as compared to implied warranties. Maybe that's a little bit of what the witness was getting at, but so there might be some unintended consequences if we were to change that from, say, an implied to an express warranty, if what we're really trying to get at is just to make sure that the homeowner has notice of those implied warranties, then maybe that's what we should say. Maybe we should say that the contractor has to give the home buyer notice of these specific implied warranties, even though implied warranties are normally implied, but I'm just a little bit concerned about if we would be changing other things in the law related to these warranties by changing them from implied to express. And again, maybe the legal expert in this area can explain if we would be doing that.
Senator Lott or Mr. Andreessen, explain to us how this works in current law, and then what does your proposed language change? Or how does your proposed language change current law?
Madam Chair, I'll just state briefly, and then Mr. Andreessen respond. The term express warranty, actually, as I see it, only appears in the description of the bill at the very beginning. But the substance of the bill actually does exactly what Senator Olson just said, which is it takes the terms of the implied warranty and says it has to be put in writing as part of the construction contract.
Okay. Then I'm more.
There's no change substantively to the warranties themselves.
Madam Chair, that makes me feel a lot better about it because I know there's different law around those two kinds of warranties.
Mr. Anderson, do you have any questions?
Ms. Anderson?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, again, I would agree. All this does today, the builder doesn't have to give the buyer of a new home or a home improvement contractor, their customer, they don't have to give them a copy of the statute. This law says give them a copy of the statute. Or, if you want, you can retype it in your contract using the same words. And the only the reason to do that is because, as Ms. Frenette points out, this is a long statute, right? And we talked earlier about how homeowners sometimes fall into little traps, like they pick up the phone and they call their builder rather than writing them a letter. If they had a copy of this statute, they would see today, notwithstanding any other amendments, hey, these are all the things I have to do to avail myself of a warranty claim. So there, and to Ms. Frenette's point about making the homeowner's responsibilities clear, 327A.03 is the list of exclusions, and it specifically says a builder is not responsible for loss or damage from the negligence, improper maintenance, or alteration of the dwelling or home improvement by the homeowner. So, I mean, it does tell the homeowner, hey, look, you've got to maintain your home. It also says it's not going to require them to pay for normal wear and tear. The statute sets those things out. This law or this bill simply says give a copy of the statute to the homeowner when they buy your house. That's it.
Ms. Frenette?
Chair, members, the statute does provide for exclusions. However, those exclusions are ambiguous enough for a homeowner not to understand what their responsibilities are when it comes forward to taking care of their house.
So should we clarify those statutory sections?
And I think Senator Latz just agreed with me because he said, Madam Chair, he'd join with me on a bill to clarify that. So,
not tonight.
Oh, please.
But on another day. Senator Latz, I've been asked to ask you to speak more directly into the mic because it's hard to hear you. Any further discussions in Senate File 776? Senator Olson moves that Senate File 776 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Are we ready for the doll bill?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Pontius and I have been going over, and it isn't quite that simple that we can just do something on the fly here, and we may have to do it right. So with your permission, we suggest, you know, we may want to just, could you just lay it over, give us a chance to work on the right language to get it the way we want it, because just the construction of the statute as it is raises some issues. Right. And we're going to need some time to figure this one out. So.
Okay. Well, Senator Dahl, then we release you from the committee and we'll bring you back at a date. This is not because the committee is not open to your bill. I think that we want to help you make it work and respond to the concerns of the committee members. So we'll bring you back maybe another couple of days when we have the language drafted. I encourage you and your testifier or your witnesses to talk with Senator Betzel and Ms. Pontius to have it worked out. And in the meantime, if Ms. Frenette or anyone else has an issue and they would like to work with you, I encourage you to work with them on it. Thank you. Senator Latz?
I would be remiss if I didn't also note on the Senate File 776 that I'm not certain whether or not Senator Metzen's committee requested that be sent there, and I wanted to at least note that for the record. If it could be verified, you could talk to staff and find out. I'm not looking for any extra stops, but I don't want to be accused of not
Senator having... Senator Latz, I appreciate you wanting to be a front. We have not received a request from Senator Metzen's office. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Madam Chair, in light of all these proposed changes to the homeowner warranty proposals, I'm sitting here kind of curious to determine whether or not there will be an insurance company that will want to insure any construction in Minnesota if these bills were passed. In light of that, then we begin to question whether or not there'll even be anyone to build homes, because a contractor will not be able to self-insure, especially in today's market. So I think we did not have that discussion. I think all of these bills should go to an appropriate committee that would handle that discussion. You know, when we changed the building codes to the energy code bills in about 1999-2000, that was not a product of the administration office on building standards and codes. That was the will of a legislature who did not know anything about building codes, who changed building codes. Basically, the mentality was, if a little insulation is good, a lot of insulation is better. And that's what resulted in most of the mold problems in the state today. That's where many of our consumers have become victimized, not necessarily by builders who are following the law and approved by state building inspectors and licensed building inspectors that were building according to the legislators' standards of construction. There was no science behind that. There was no field testing of that. And now we have all of the victims, of course, only going after the builders who followed the law in many cases. Now that the building code has been altered, we no longer have some of the more egregious mold problems from the late 1990s to maybe 2002-2003 of buildings that were constructed during that time. But I honestly believe that if the consumers really want to go after the people that are really at fault, I think the state of Minnesota has a lot to be parked into that liability picture. I know attorneys don't necessarily want to go sue a state, but nevertheless, if there's any fault, it's this senator's opinion that the legislature is the one that caused most of these mold problems for the consumers of Minnesota.
Noted.
And I don't know if we're going to have a building community building new homes anymore if these, despite the fact that there's some sincere attempt to cure the problems of our consumers, I don't think there's any money there in today's market. And if the insurance industry does not offer building insurance for contractors, if these were passed, then this industry will be all but dead. And then we've got other problems in trying to handle the needs of the poor, in trying to create adequate housing, low-income housing, not to mention just average folks that need a house from now and then. So I hope we don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg by the number of bills that came before this committee today.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. And to our members of the audience, members of the committee, I think we need to take a little bit of a break. So I'm going to recess us until 7 o'clock so we can all get a bite to eat and give Ms. Pandias here a little bit of a rest. So the committee stands in recess until 7 o'clock.